Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuvah, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
So we're talking about Yom Teruah, and today I want to talk about Yom Teruah, the great shofar and the Messiah. So we're entering into the fall holy day season. Our first holy day is Yom Teruah, the day of blowing. It's about blowing the shofars. And the meaning of the day is simply this, that when you hear the shofars being blown, it's to remind us judgment is coming. Judgment is coming. 10 more days, and we encounter the day of judgment called Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And this is the type and shadow of the eschatological great end times white throne judgment where Jesus and all of us in him will judge the living and the dead and bring history to a close and enter into the new age to come. It's going to be amazing in every way. These days are types and shadows of what is coming. And I want to remind you that when the shofar is blown, that's a call to wake up and turn to God and receive his mercy and his salvation. God's not about judgment. He's about salvation. He's warning us over and over and over to receive from him the atonement of his son that we might experience mercy and salvation before judgment falls. Amen? So neglect what the type and shadow is and neglect the reality and you will experience judgment rather than salvation. That's what these days are all about. So, Yom Teruah, the great shofar, and the Messiah. This issue of Yom Teruah, the blowing of the shofar, is fascinating. You'll find a lot of texts throughout the scriptures related to this holy day. But there's one in particular I want us to look at. It's the only passage that talks about a great shofar. All the other passages talk about the blowing of the shofars or the blowing of the trumpets. But one passage talks about this great shofar that's blown, and something significant happens as a result of the great shofar in contradistinction to the other times in which the shofars are being blown. So I'm going to jump into Matthew 24, where we encounter this passage that's so intriguing, and I'm just sick because I don't think I'm going to be able to get to it, but I'm going to try. So Matthew 24, 29 through 31. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened. Yeshua speaking. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Here's our verse, verse 31. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Please leave that up for a moment. He will gather from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other, his elect, when that great trumpet is blown. The great trumpet. Now, if you notice, it's all in caps. Why? It's a quote. He's referring to something already written. And actually, it's a text in the Tanakh. The great gathering is also referred to in light of the great trumpet. It too is referred in that same passage in the Tanakh. The question is, does this passage have to do with Rosh Hashanah? Is this passage a Yom Teruah prophecy? The answer is yes, it is. And if so, and it is, how will we actualize this and apply it and share it with others? Good questions. I'm glad you asked. So let's begin. Yom Teruah, the great shofar, and the prophecies about the Messiah. Context is king. That's one of the principles in hermeneutics. Your context is everything. If you want to understand a sentence, a phrase, a verse, you have to see it in its immediate context and in its larger context. So context is king. Keep in mind, the context of Matthew 24 and verse 29 through 31 is part of the section of Yeshua's prophecies concerning the fall of Jerusalem, that's Matthew 23, his ascension into heaven to receive his Father's kingdom, that's found in Matthew 24, referred back in Daniel chapter 7, and also the destruction of the temple. It's the opening verses of Matthew 24, and the beginning of the gathering of the elect into the kingdom of God, which has come to this world, the world in which we live, through Yeshua in his first coming, his death, and his resurrection. So according to this context, all of these things, the fall of Jerusalem, his ascension into heaven, the destruction of the temple, the gathering, the beginning of the gathering, all these things that he's referred to in this passage, all of these things must take place in his generation. Matthew 24:34, he says this, "Truly I say to you, this generation, not that generation 2,000 years later, or some other generation." He says, this generation, in the ears of the hearers, their generation, that generation, will not pass away until all these things take place. That's the context of our passage. So, big question. Did they all take place in that generation 2,000 years ago? If not, then the followers of Jesus have some insurmountable problems with him and his movement. But I say yes, they all took place. They all came to pass in that generation. Now I've laid that out in like an 8 or 9 or 10 part series like 2 years ago. Go get it. I have no time to cover that ground. I already did. We've got just minutes here in our service. But go back and look at that. Those things that he said were going to come to pass actually came to pass in that generation. So, let me just give you the short and quick, and then you can go back and spend some time working through the passages. I'm going to use some Jewish scholarship that will help make sense out of these passages. It is a Jewish setting, a Jewish cultural backdrop to the passage, and so this will help us understand the passage. Keep in mind that genre is a crucial key for interpreting the passage. And what is the literary genre of our passage in Matthew 24, verses 29 through 31? Apocalyptic. Now, in fact, this passage is listed in works on exegesis, in systematic theology as well, but this passage is going to be listed as an apocalyptic gospel narrative. And what are the primary features of apocalyptic literature? Rich symbolism. When you're going to interpret a passage where the literary style is apocalyptic in nature, then you're going to have rich symbolism in that passage. It's going to be filled with symbolism. It's code for don't take the passage literally. That would be a big mistake. It's going to be filled with symbols, visions, dreams, cosmic catastrophes. The writer is going to cast it with hyperboles, where he overstates his case to make his point. Radical transformation of nature and nations, the end of the age, and the entrance of the kingdom of God. And I want to tell you, that first century was just that. Jesus came. Babe born in Bethlehem, who was none other than the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Yeah, everything that happened the first century surrounding him was cataclysmic in terms of what it would do to this world in which we live in. Amazing in every way. So let's explore the passage at hand in light of its historical, cultural context and in light of its literary genre. Matthew 24, 29 through 31. Jesus says, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." Don't take that literally. The genre is apocalyptic. You got to understand that spiritually through the value of symbols. So let's look at what's being stated through the value of symbols. What's it referring to about the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. If it's not literally the sun and the moon, what's he referring to? And the stars falling from the sky. What's that in reference to? Heaven's going to be shaken itself? Amazing. Now, if you go back and study the backdrop to this imagery, you'll find that it begins a long time ago in Genesis with the story of Joseph and his brothers. Remember that story? Joseph had a dream. Oh, yeah. Genesis 37, verse 9. Now, he had still another dream, speaking of Joseph. And he related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Now, do you think he's talking about literally the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing to him? No, it's a dream. And dreams are filled with symbols. If you understand the symbol, you'll understand the meaning of the dream. If you try to take this literally, it makes no sense. It creates problems. It's a dream. What's it referring to? Verse 10. He related it to his father and his brothers. He told his fathers and his brothers this dream about the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowing down. How many brothers does he have? 11. Thank you. Spot on. You know where this is going. He related it to his father, to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? Joseph, what are you thinking?" Right? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. The dream concerning the sun and the moon, Jacob being a good Yid, a good Jew, understood the symbol. He said, "Are you saying that I, the sun, and your mother, the moon, and your brother, the 11 stars, the very nation of God, the very chosen, the elect of God, the prince of God, is going to bow to you, son?" So based on this dream, down through the corridor of history, Jacob, Rachel, and the sons are often described and depicted through the metaphors, figures of speech, of the sun and the moon and the stars, of heaven itself. Even Paul refers to Jerusalem not just in the natural, but in the heavenlies, calling Jerusalem above the mother of us all. So, keep that in mind. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky. Symbolically, what he's saying is, Israel is going to fall. Israel's going to go through a dark time, and even her sons, her children, will perish in a great tribulation. This heavenly city, this heavenly people will be shaken and brought down. Now you think about this for a minute. When Jesus earlier talks about the tribulation coming to them that will come in that generation before him, he says, "This is the vengeance of our God." That God is going to shake his people, and he's going to break his people because they were so filled with sin in their day and had gone on for so many generations that God was going to come once again and the city would fall and the temple would be destroyed. The Great Tribulation, 68 to 70 AD. That was the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. Even Josephus, the great Jewish historian, says that this was the greatest tribulation that Israel ever experienced in her entire history as a nation. And keep in mind, she had some pretty amazing falls before this. So, if you were to describe these prophetic events that Jesus spoke of by way of apocalyptic genre, it would be similar to what Matthew already stated. The words of Jesus. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, specifically 68 to 70 AD, Israel will fall. The sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Israel falls. The heavens are shaken. This is exactly what happened. Israel went on to be scattered throughout the world. And she did not rise again until 1948, nearly 2,000 years later. That, my friends, is exactly what Yeshua prophesied. And this is exactly what came to pass, the culmination being AD 70. Verse 30, it goes on to say, and then, after the tribulation, it says, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. This is an amazing part of this description as well. What's he referring to about the sign of the Son of Man appearing in the sky? In the midst of the great tribulation, he says that the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. What's he referring to? And did that appear in the sky? I would say yes. I would say that 68 to 70 had amazing signs and wonders taking place. Josephus, who did not believe Jesus was the Messiah, actually records the miracles that were taking place even in the heavenlies during that horrible siege on Jerusalem, where it was choked off by Rome and its mercenary armies. It was such a devastation to Israel that even wives were eating their children. People were dying of starvation. The city was locked off. Hundreds were crucified and thrown over the walls. Pestilence everywhere. So, did the sign appear during that time? The sign of the Son of Man in the sky? Yeah, this is interesting. Again, if you understand the symbolic value, you'll catch it. If you try to take this literally, you'll miss it. It didn't happen then, and it's not happening in the future. That literally will not take place. For the literal sun to go dark and the moon not to shine, of course, obviously, because it's a reflection of the sun, but if the sun just went, boop, burned out like that, we'd die within minutes. We would, this thing, it's over. It's not talking about a literal event. It's talking symbolically about what's going to happen to Jerusalem and the people of Israel. So the word sky here that we translate with our English word sky from the Greek, it's actually a Greek word that has several nuances, one being heaven, heaven, as the spiritual dimension where God dwells. So, did the sign of the Son of Man appear in heaven where God dwells? What sign? The one Daniel said, that one like the Son of Man is going to ascend on the clouds. Where? Into heaven. Stand before the Ancient of Days. Receive a kingdom, power, authority, and glory, and rule and reign. Is that not what took place in Jesus' ascension? Did he not ascend into the heavens? Did he not go before the Father in the clouds and receive power and glory and authority, becoming King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Absolutely took place in the first century. It goes on, and we're going to end it here. It says, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Now, I can't finish. I'm going to finish it next week. Maybe next week. I don't even know when we're going to finish it. But keep in mind that he is the Son of Man. He ascends. He receives the kingdom. The question is, did all the tribes of the land, that's the Greek word can mean land of Israel or the whole world, did all the tribes, we'll say of the land because it's a first century Jerusalem phenomenon, that's the context, did all the tribes of Israel see that? Now, we're going to go into this next week, and I'll demonstrate to you that exactly what the passage is saying, they got it. And Josephus even understood that. Even when they were launching the catapults of 100-pound stones, the same weight of the stones referred to in the book of Revelation, falling on the temple, they were shouting out when they were launching those 100-pound rocks. They could see them coming, and they would cue everyone as to when the next one was coming, and they'd all hit the deck, so to speak. But they would quote this passage. They would scream out. They'd say, "The Son of Man cometh," identifying this destruction of Jerusalem with the prophecy that Yeshua gave. Josephus says he doesn't know if it was in mockery of that or if they literally believed that it was tied into that. But nonetheless, you can connect the dots. So next week, I'll get more into this and I'll share with you what this is all about. Are you saying, Mark, you don't believe in the second coming of Jesus? Absolutely, I do. This passage is not talking about the second coming of Jesus. Those are other passages. This passage deals with events surrounding the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD and his ascension, where he receives the power, the glory, and the honor to rule and reign. That's amazing in every way. How does it tie into Rosh Hashanah? I will tell you at some point. I apologize, but stay tuned. Come back, and we'll finish this up in the future. Thank you.
Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And we add, in the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha, Yaher Adonai panavalecha ve'yihunecha, Yisa Adonai panavalecha ve'asem lecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehila Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat Shalom and Shavua Tov. Shabbat.